what took place at the Colleyville Synagogue. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a human resources manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Amin Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warren, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
And this is radio station WUSB Stony Brook, broadcasting at 90.1 FM and 107.3 FM, as well as over the internet on WUSB.FM. It's 6 o'clock on a Tuesday, which means it's once again time for Off the Wall. A very good evening for everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm doing everything.
Well, yeah, we're all doing everything. Oh, my God. This is it's production week for us, so we're very busy and haven't had time for anything. I can't believe it's Tuesday. Are you sure it's Tuesday? You just told me this 10 minutes ago.
I think it's Tuesday.
So we have to do a show now. Okay, yeah, we can do that. We can do that. I just, you know, I don't have anything prepared. I did. No one told me it was Tuesday. So, yeah, happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday.
Yeah.
It's like an underwater volcano of news.
Oh, that's funny, because one of the news stories is about an underwater volcano that hit the island nation of Tonga.
Did you hear about this? There was a tsunami warning on all coasts all around the Pacific Rim, I guess.
Yeah.
Is how it is referred to. This nation, Tonga, very close by, and bore the brunt of an incredible seismic and geologic event. There's ash and untold destruction. We weren't able to hear of anything. I was trying to find radio. I was trying to find any kind of broadcast.
Well, I don't know how to get bulletins back on my phone. Once you read them, I think they're gone forever. But the bulletin that I got about an hour or so ago, maybe 2 hours ago, that doesn't mean that's when it came out. That's when I got it. So it could be days between when it gets sent out and when I actually am able to receive it. But it said that all houses on a particular island in Tonga were destroyed. And this as the first words are heard from Tonga, which is really kind of dramatic. Apparently there's an underwater cable from Fiji to Tonga, and that connects them to the outside world, and that was cut. So we haven't been able to hear anything from them until now, where they said, yeah, all the houses on at least one of the islands were destroyed, and many others on other islands as well. But it was just kind of a weird thing to hear in the first words heard since the disaster.
Yeah, and just a severe disaster, total devastation. In hearing so little, your imagination just, our thoughts, I guess, and marshaling resources, some kind of response. They're worried about infection. Yeah, from help. When
infection from help.
When aid and resources come in.
Seems a little ungrateful, if you ask me.
Check on people.
Yeah.
Isn't that incredible?
No, you don't want our help then, huh?
But
okay.
It is a consideration. And
I totally understand
that. So hopefully precautions.
If you're not an island person, maybe you got the cooties.
People from the mainland. Mm. It's always people from the mainland.
Which mainland is it? Because I can't, you know, I profess my ignorance constantly, but in this particular case, I could not find Tonga on a map. I think it's somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, but do you really expect me to be able to pinpoint where exactly? It's not off the coast of California. It's pretty much, you know, out there. Where all the other countries are, you know, and maybe to the south a little bit. That's what I would say.
Yes, it's much closer to places like New Zealand.
Yeah, sure, but that still means they're thousands of miles away from it, probably.
Yeah, it's very remote, and this event, I don't even venture to say, oh, gee, if it was closer. No, this was it. This was incredibly close. It's terrifying. The people there have been devastated, and you can be assured need a lot of help. And I wish we could have like a news story about this.
Can we bring up Tonga radio or something? Is there such a thing?
I was looking.
Well, if their cable has been cut. I guess there isn't such a thing right now for us, at least.
They're probably relying on anyone who can transmit and at high enough ground. I don't know the terrain, like what the land is like there. And
is that true? Oh, thank you.
Oops,
I'm told that this is the most we have ever talked about Tonga in not only this radio show's history, but all the radio shows that I've been involved with. Can we check that? Okay. I believe it. I don't think we've ever even talked about
Tonga.
I'm
more astounded by us.
Uh-huh.
Really? Because
why don't we talk about Tonga?
How has it not come up?
Does it take an underwater volcano for us to notice something? Well, I'd like to notice the underwater volcanoes. Are there underwater volcanoes off the coast of Long Island? You know, let us know these things. I'm sure the people of Tonga were aware that there was an underwater volcano about to erupt or that could erupt. Were they? I don't know. I'm not sure. Who's in charge?
Well, they themselves are probably the result of past eruptions in some ways.
Are like you saying they're living on a volcano?
Well, the island formations, aren't they volcanic? Like in Hawaii, it's volcanic. Like there's volcanoes there. They're like features of volcanic rock that slowly rise above the ocean and form land, right? That's
I'm reading up on the Wikipedia page now of Tonga. I'm learning a lot. I learned that they just have over 100,000 residents in Tonga, which basically is like Stony Brook times four. That's the population of the entire country. And well, if a volcano went off at Stony Brook, I'm sure it would be getting more coverage than Tonga, probably just because of its distance. But yeah, it's kind of, I'm looking at the map now. It's kind of where I thought it was in that part of the world. So, all right. We'll keep updated on this series of circumstances.
Yeah. Like I said, I wish I had more information about it. And, I'm sure there's a lot of people that are concerned and following up. So,
do you know what the official language of Tonga is?
No. Enlighten me.
Tongan, Kyle. Wasn't that hard to figure out. just stick an N at the end of it. Tongan is the official, along with English, so we could get by there. Tongan, by the way, is a Polynesian language closely related to, Wallisian, Niuean, and Hawaiian. Okay, I know Hawaiian. Do you know Hawaii? Have you ever heard Hawaiian spoken? I mean, Hawaii is a state. You've been to Hawaii. I've never been to Hawaii. It's the one state I haven't been to. But I'm not familiar with the Hawaiian language. Have you heard it spoken when you were over there?
Yes. In fact, a lot of things come from that language, as you can imagine, in any locality. They're named after the communities and traditional names. That's a familiar thing here. So, yeah, it's all around, but not nearly enough.
I'm not sure how this is relevant, but by some published surveys, Tonga has one of the highest obesity rates in the world. World Health Organization data published in 2014 indicate that Tonga stands fourth overall in terms of countries listed by mean body mass index. Okay, I've got to look this up. Who is number one? Who do you think is number one on this list?
I feel...
List. I love Wikipedia. List of countries by body mass index. That is a page. Come on, who's number one? I'm not looking. I'm not looking.
I know there's some other Pacific Islands in there.
I know this is one chart that we do well on, you know, if being number one is considered good. If Tonga is number four, then that means other small countries can also be high up. So where do the sumo wrestlers come from?
Well,
I'm not saying a whole nation of sumo wrestlers.
Japan.
Is that Japan?
I'm going to say Samoa's up there.
Samoa, that's what I was thinking of.
That's what you're thinking of.
I think Samoa is up there too. I don't know why, but I just... I've heard that said. I think we're in the top 10 at least, because you know those smaller countries with lots of fat people might have an unfair advantage because it takes fewer of them to have the overall percentage. But I think you gotta give us some credit for the obesity that we promote.
Yeah, and I know there's some problems in the Mideast and places like India where they're are aspects of the diet that are changing. And mm-hmm. They're having problems with obesity just as much.
Yeah, but you
much.
Have so many people in India that are not
fat.
Yeah, that's
true.
That's going to change the balance.
Okay, this is why, I mean, I shouldn't be guessing. I shouldn't be the one determining
this. A sparsely populated country that's well-fed, and that brings you to the top of the list.
All right, yeah. I mean, that's what we're assuming. Wait, can we stop exploring how wrong I am and not
But you haven't said anything yet, so you haven't been proven wrong.
I did.
Yet.
I said Samoa. What?
Well, I didn't say Samoa wasn't on. I haven't looked at the list yet.
Okay.
So you could be right. It could be number one. Could be Samoan. So that's a good guess. All right. But we need to think of a couple of others as well. You know, I'm going to say, I want to say Brazil, but no, there's too many people there. I don't know if they would rank as high as the U.S. Maybe Russia. There are some fat Russians, right?
Okay.
I don't want to insult anybody. I'm trying to...
And less people, right?
Maybe there's a Western European country that's particularly fat that doesn't have that many people so that they would count more. England. I'm going to say England. There's some fatties over there.
Some blokes that are putting on the stones.
Uh-huh. And, you know, this we're not passing judgment of any sort. We're simply, this is a Wikipedia page, list of countries by body mass index, which I think is fascinating. Okay, you ready for number one?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Number one is, what? Nauru.
Okay. That's a tiny island.
Number two is Tonga. I thought number four was Tonga. Did I misremember what I said myself? Number two is Tonga. Number three is Samoa. Very good, Kyle.
Oh.
Number four, Kuwait.
That's what
there
I was...
There you go. Middle East, like you said. You know, I want to say a sparsely populated country, but a tiny country.
That's affluent and, not...
Most of these countries are small. St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia, Kiribati, okay. That's in the Pacific. Palau.
Never knew anything about Kiribati.
Micronesia.
Okay, yeah.
Tuvalu. Okay, so where is the United States in this? Jordan, they're number 15. Egypt is number 13. The Bahamas are 17.
It's because of the way
we're
it's
arranged. We're number 20. United States is 20.
Yeah, statistical reorienting there.
Okay, but you know what? We are the biggest country. To come in that high up. So I'm looking, Mexico is number 24.
Biggest of the big countries, okay.
Argentina is number 32. Not seeing anybody from Europe. Greece, that's Greece, number 41. Okay, United Kingdom is number 40. So, all right, well, I learned something. I learned something from that underwater volcano. What else? You're watching Ukrainian TV right now. Why are we watching Ukrainian TV?
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff going on there, and I was trying to also keep up with, various stuff that is being reported and just basically getting any live shots, and I found this interesting online TV station.
What's it called?
Espresso.
Espresso is the name of the Ukrainian TV
station? Isn't that funny? I mean, it's cool.
Are you sure that's right? Espresso? Really?
I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, but yeah, it's like an internet-only broadcaster. In 2013, November 2013, it started.
Espresso.tv, that's their site, with one S. Mm-hmm. Espresso.tv.
It enabled the Euromaidan protests to be broadcast worldwide.
Wow.
Okay. And they're showing like historical stuff now. But they showed a live press conference of Poroshenko at trial. He basically got stopped at the border, and they took his passport. Now, this is the former leader of Ukraine.
Oh, the one who went all Russian.
I think so.
Russian.
Yeah.
Okay, and he came back?
I think so. Yeah, he came back. He's a Ukrainian oligarch and chocolate baron. He is known for this chocolate company that he ran. But anyway, had this trial and they covered it live. And that was the only way to really see what was going on there. But I was trying to read how this what this meant. You know, what is going on? What kind of things are at play here? Is this a way to stabilize or destabilize? And you know, or is it just a coincidence? And it was really interesting.
Well, of course, a lot of other things are happening in Ukraine right now. And in fact, I'm looking at a story. this is a weird headline. In extremely dangerous moment, top U.S. diplomat travels to Ukraine to meet Russian counterpart. It's just, they make it sound like the meeting is what's extremely dangerous, but the situation, I guess, is what they're referring to. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is traveling to Ukraine, Germany, and Switzerland this week, a sign, quote, perhaps that diplomacy is not dead, a senior State Department official said today, as Russia continues to mass troops and military equipment near Ukraine's borders, including now in allied Belarus, their allies, not our allies. The U.S. and European countries have become increasingly concerned the Kremlin may be preparing to launch an attack on Ukraine. You know, this whole thing, it's...
I heard about this.
What do you make of this?
Wow. What do I make of it? It's a geopolitics at large, changing form. The areas of interest where global powers have concern mm-hmm. are changing its dynamic. They're refocusing. The Mideast was a real priority, and that change has been evident. And so there's other responses and reactions.
The concern is that Russia is moving in on Ukraine. First of all, they already did move in on Ukraine a number of years ago. But the concern now is that they're going to move in more. It's just kind of weird that the U.S. is more concerned about this, at least it appears that way, than countries that are much closer, particularly countries in Europe, Eastern Europe, in that general region. So it's become sort of this Russia versus U.S. crisis instead of maybe Russia versus, say, Poland and Germany and Hungary and other countries that maybe would have more of an interest in keeping Russia at a distance. When the United States gets involved in it, though, it's kind of like, what are we doing all the way over there? You know, why is it all about the U.S.? This should be about NATO. NATO is a number of countries. But whenever they refer to NATO, it seems they're referring to the United States. It doesn't feel right. It feels like, you know, just like with China, we're on the other side of the world dictating terms. And not saying that the terms necessarily are incorrect or unfair, but why? Why is it the United States? Why isn't it the rest of the world if this is such a global issue?
I think that's a fair question. I think that's what what is being asked of the U.S. in many ways, mm-hmm. because there was a huge critique of NATO and the U.S.'s contributions in the last administration, which was unsettling. So I think the other member states are like, well, so is NATO still the thing that we're going to do here? Or, you know, what is the prerogative of this organization, especially when other alliances and interests are evident and changing before our eyes? How is this something based in sort of historic precedent, this North Atlantic Treaty Organization? What does that mean now? Mm-hmm. When you say you're going to be a member of this thing, or that they should take a lead, and it doesn't seem like other states care. Well, maybe that thing is that they're on the phone saying, hey, NATO, what's up? You know, I don't know. It's emerging, and the questions, you know, it's important to, I think the thing, that's the tricky part, is that the U.S. does not want to be involved.
Well, I'm going to read you the list of NATO members, just so we can be clear on this. And I'm also going to note the members that used to be under Soviet influence, because that's important as well. Just to give you a sense as to how things have changed in the last few decades. Albania, not really under Soviet influence because they were isolationists, but certainly not under Western influence. They're, you know, a fairly new nation to join NATO. So Albania, definitely a change. Then Belgium, Western Europe, so that was a country that was always there. Bulgaria, most certainly under Soviet influence. Canada, Croatia, again under Soviet influence. Czech Republic, Soviet influence. Denmark, Estonia, Soviet influence. France, Germany, well, East Germany was under Soviet influence. Greece, Hungary, again Soviet influence. Iceland, Italy, Latvia, Soviet influence. Lithuania, Soviet influence. Luxembourg, Montenegro, Soviet influence. Netherlands, North Macedonia, new name for the country, but Soviet influence, former Yugoslavia. Norway, Poland, Soviet influence. Portugal, Romania, Soviet influence, even though they had this crazy Ceausescu guy running things independent of the Soviet Union, but definitely under Soviet influence. Slovakia, again, part of the former Yugoslavia. I'm sorry, Slovakia. I was thinking Slovenia. Slovakia, part of Czechoslovakia, yes, under former Soviet influence. Slovenia, former Yugoslavia, under Soviet influence. Spain, Turkey, United Kingdom, United States. So there are a lot of countries in there that used to be under Soviet influence. Now, let's go inside Putin's head for a second. Scary, I know. But look at all the countries that used to be under the Soviet sphere and now are in NATO. And Ukraine is about to become part of NATO too in his eyes. So I can understand why he's angry, concerned, maybe even panicking about losing yet more of that former sphere of influence. Doesn't make it right, but at least let's try to understand where this guy is coming from and not attribute to him motives of insanity or just this doesn't make any sense. Why is he doing this? It's obvious why he's doing this. You know, the same thing will happen if Georgia ever expresses an interest in joining NATO, or if that becomes anything close to a reality. Belarus, well, they're not likely to do anything like that because they want more than anything for the Soviet Union to come back. So you have that situation. So what do we do about it? How do we deal with this? Any ideas or theories or no? I'm asking to solve the world's problems, Kyle. No, you don't have an answer right. I think I might have an answer. I think I might have, you know, a crazy enough idea that could work, but it'll never be done because we're too stubborn.
Well, you're saying what do we do about it? But at the same time, you're arguing we don't have to do anything, like that the U.S. ought not be meddling or whatever in your Putin point of view.
I mean, that is an option, not do anything, but it seems as... how about NATO? We say, what does NATO do about this? It shouldn't be the United States, yes. But NATO, all these countries, many of which are former Soviet sphere countries, what is the answer? How do we get Russia to back off and not invade Ukraine? First of all, I don't think an invasion of Ukraine would be very successful because most of Ukraine has no interest in being part of a Russian-dominated nation.
That's a heck of a way to convince them.
Well, yeah, if they want a civil war that's going to go on for, or basically a war between two nations that'll go on for a long, long time. Or perhaps they want a particular section of the country which is more sympathetic to Russia than to Ukraine.
Didn't they just do that? This is deja vu.
Well, I don't
feel
know
like
if they
I've
did.
Seen this movie before.
There's Russian-occupied Ukraine in the east, which is more favorable towards Russian influence. But honestly, the people just want to be left alone. But again, you know, the same thing in Georgia, where you have these Russian separatist sections. You wonder why would the government of Georgia want to hold on to these hostile provinces that don't want to be part of that country? What's the advantage? You just have these people that are always angry at you and trying to get away from you. Well, maybe it's the same in Ukraine. I don't know if it's nearly as bad as it is in Georgia. But here is the idea that I have to basically solve this. Crimea, as you may remember, is the section of Ukraine that the Russians annexed a few years ago. Now, most of the world, in fact, I think pretty much every country does not recognize that Crimea is part of Russia now and not part of Ukraine, which, you know, is kind of unrealistic because, well, it is right now. It is because they're running everything. So it's certainly part of that country and not part of Ukraine anymore. Ukraine has no authority there. But why? Why did they take this particular region back? Well, strategic reasons, of course, which is why the United States is so interested in not having Russia have the Crimea. But why was it part of Ukraine in the first place? Well, it might surprise you to know that it wasn't always part of Ukraine. In fact, it was part of Russia, the Russian Soviet Republic. And here's what happened. I took another trip to Wikipedia. And under this section called Khrushchev and Brezhnev, 1953 to 1985, leaders of the Soviet Union, the policy of de-Stalinization took two main features. Okay, let's skip over that part. But here we go. In February 1954, the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, the Russian Soviet Republic, let's call it that, transferred Crimea as a gift to Ukraine from the Russians. It was a gift in 1954. Even if only 22% of the Crimean population were ethnic Ukrainian. So it was transferred. It was basically won in a card game or something. It had never been part of Ukraine before that, or maybe hundreds of years ago. Who knows? But in the last century, it was part of the Russian Soviet Republic. And then one day Khrushchev said, you know what, I'm going to give this to Ukraine as a gift. Much like, you know, the Soviets gave buildings to other countries as gifts. And you couldn't turn it down. You had to accept that. So all of a sudden, this is now part of Ukrainian Soviet Republic. Now, what's the difference to the West? It doesn't make any difference. So what? It's a Ukrainian. It could be Lithuanian. It's all part of the Soviet Union. Doesn't make any difference. And as mentioned, the Ukrainian population in that particular area, small compared to the Russian population. So by all rights, it seems like it's justified that this be part of Russia. I don't see what the issue is, other than the fact that strategically, yeah, it's bad for NATO. I agree. But what if the West said, you know what, we're going to recognize Crimea as being part of Russia, but you get your troops out of there and commit to never invading Ukraine? I don't know. I think that would work. What do we lose? What do we lose, and what could we gain?
Okay. I see that.
Kyle, but why would that not work?
Okay. Now, what did you get a gift for your birthday?
What do you mean?
Now, I'm holding a box. Maybe it's your birthday gift, and say I take it back.
Okay.
You know, I got you something, and then I take it back.
Okay. Well, that just means you're a nasty person.
See, you no, I'm upset.
Well, no, I'm sad.
I heard half a
I'm
sniffle.
I'm sad. I'm disappointed. But I'm not going to invade. I don't even know how that would work.
You would think it was rude that I took a gift back from you.
Yeah, except you know what? The same person that I was when you gave me the gift. I'm not a part of your Soviet Union that somehow I was a part of at the time. It was all one country. It was a Soviet Union. It was like transferring from North Dakota to South Dakota.
So you have to
insult
me.
The people spoke different languages, but you know, it was basically the same country.
Oh, I get it. So I get the gift back and you insult me. You say it was a lame gift or it didn't mean anything to you.
Well, I don't think anyone in Ukraine is saying Crimea didn't mean anything to them. They definitely want it back.
I think they have opinions.
But the point is, it was Russian historically. It's majority Russian.
No,
if you had a vote to say what country do you want to go to, it would undoubtedly be Russia. But the West will never allow such a vote to take place. They will claim the whole premise is illegitimate. This is where we get stuck. Okay, we have to yield something. And this is a good thing to yield because we're not going to win. We're not going to get it back. It's going to be part of Russia. They have the might. They have the people. They have the history. So why not? It's an easy giveaway. Just say, you know what? Crimea is yours. We recognize it now. And lots of advantages to being officially recognized. You have a strategic plus here. Just back off from Ukraine. I think that would work tomorrow.
And then what happens after that?
After that, we try and get along better. I don't know. We basically try to see things from the eyes of other sides. Okay, you know, when you have this massive military coalition that's moving closer and closer to you, you might get a little paranoid, and that's what I see Putin getting. So, okay, you know, NATO has grown quite a bit. I think NATO is okay. As long as certain countries are protected, they don't necessarily have to be part of NATO. So we can put that on hold for now, as far as Ukraine joining. And maybe things can get a little bit more peaceful, less tense. Would be nice.
Well, I hope there weren't any other gifts that were involved over the history
I don't
of
know
Ukraine.
Did Khrushchev give away other,
it'd just
other
be
parts
like
of the country?
A yard sale here, just left and right, just dismantling the whole thing.
Well, I mean, this is something that I think is easy. So, I don't know. Someone tell me, otw@2600.com. Why wouldn't that work? Someone tell me that. Who's displaced by this? And yeah, I know there are Ukrainians in Crimea that aren't happy with what's going on. But again, it's something that historically there's this precedent here.
We're open. We have time to go through all the ideas. So yeah, otw@2600.com. We'd love to hear your solutions to de-escalating and drawing a line with Russia. Do we do that, or when does anyone draw any line?
No, it's bad to have this. I keep seeing all these people saying, yes, war is inevitable. No, it's not. War is stupid. It's not something that ever has to happen. you can always have talks, mutual respect, and work things out. It's only when you fail to do that that war becomes inevitable. And this is a stupid thing to go to war over with, for two superpowers. It's just insane. And a lot of the people running things now really don't have half a clue. I'm not claiming I have more of a clue, but you got to start thinking of other ideas as well.
What is the official stance on that territory? Like, what's it labeled as?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not
sure. Is Ukraine a country?
Well, Ukraine is certainly a country.
Okay, good. Yes. I just wanted to check.
But and Crimea, that's what I assume you're asking.
I'm wondering what it's labeled as or what the official
disputed territory
state, like U.S. and what other NATO members, how they look at. Because it's not just the U.S. That's the whole point of the conversation is why are we involved? We're involved because we're part of NATO. So what do other NATO members,
especially NATO should do. I think NATO
former Soviet members, as you said, what do they think about Crimea and what do they think about where there is buildup along various borders? How do they feel about that if it becomes something protracted and there are refugees or fallout or
and let's also remember that there is oppression of Russian minorities in many former Soviet republics. In fact, the Balkans, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, many times. I remember one time, I forget which one of the countries, Russians had to get passports in order to travel to Russia. And it was horribly unfair to make them have to go through all this extra paperwork just because of their ethnic nationality. So there's basically all kinds of injustices on all sides. It's not a one-sided thing. But yeah, Putin is somebody to be very cautious of. And the nationalism that he espouses and the hatred and the things he does to journalists are absolutely terrible. In no way is reaching some kind of an agreement with him accepting any of that. But
I don't know, appeasing belligerence, like as it emerges and continues on and on and on. It just seems like it doesn't stop if you accept it.
Right. But again, you have to be realistic. What is the alternative to that? Sending in your own troops and having a protracted battle that's eventually going to involve the entire world? Is it worth that? Or is there something?
No, it's Ukraine and NATO, right? That's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about going in there.
Right. But, as a member of NATO, we are obligated to step in if any country is attacked. But Ukraine isn't part of NATO. Anyway, we have other problems to solve in this. We only have an hour. We're supposed to solve problems of the world this hour. Voting rights. Okay, that's the other thing.
So crucial.
It really is. It's being voted on today or tomorrow. It's being voted on. But the problem is that the filibuster is going to prevent it from even coming up for debate, let alone having it pass. And the reason why we can't get past the filibuster is because of two Democratic senators, Manchin and Sinema. Same thing over and over and over again. Okay, it's important to have the vote so that you can at least say all the Republicans voted against voting rights. Boy, I wish we could somehow use the voting rights against them. You know, the way they try and keep people from voting. Why can't we keep them from voting? They'd see it that way. They'd see that this is unfair. I'm being oppressed here. Yeah, that's the point.
They don't get water when they're like in line waiting to get into the
chamber. It's illegal to give a Republican water while they're lined up to vote in the Senate. I don't know.
Yeah.
their own medicine. Just give them a healthy dose of that. But the thing is to have it on record.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I agree what Manchin and Sinema are doing is terrible. But let's not forget there are 50 Republican senators who were not even considering being able to be reasoned with. So all of those people right there are also responsible. Let's not let them off the hook. Just because they're Republicans doesn't mean they get to do this and not pay the price, not get criticized. Yes, Manchin and Sinema, especially bad because they supposedly are Democrats. They shouldn't be doing something like this. But here's my idea to how to solve this. First of all, we have the vote, so it's on record. And the vote fails because we can't get past the filibuster. All right. Manchin, Sinema, we've heard what they have to say. They don't want to abolish the filibuster because somehow that would be harmful to the system. Never mind that the system is unjust and basically is used by racists to get their way and minority rule and all that. Okay, fine. So you don't want to do this. You know what? You, Manchin and Sinema, you are now in charge of the voting rights bill. It's your bill. Get it passed. Figure it out. Because you say this is not the way to go. And you support this bill. I hope they support this bill. Okay, how do we do it? How do we do it? We want you to either figure out a way, or we want you two to come up on camera and say, yeah, we tried, but the Republicans, they just wouldn't get out of the way. But you know what? We're going to let them do that. I want to see that press conference. I want to see them be forced to say that their way doesn't work. And will they refuse the responsibility of being in charge of this particular bill? You know, it's now your bill because, you know, we've tried everything we can. And obviously you have a better idea because you don't want to abolish the filibuster. That was our idea. We thought that would work. Okay. You don't think it's going to work? What's the plan? Or do you really just not want voter rights to pass at all? Because if that's true, we need to hear that. So it doesn't necessarily solve the problem, but I think it gets a more of a focus as to where people are coming from.
Truly. Yeah. It's so, so sad to have to get to these depths of process and technical maneuvers and machinations of the system that we have, but I don't know. I think just the more pressure and discussion and clarity of the kinds of real right that we're seeing disappear, like that stuff is being eroded. It needs to be driven home so that people are protecting their interest in this system, because it's going to become more in shambles than it feels like it's at this moment. But it's terribly crucial. I don't care. I mean, it's not the, like, there needs to be, it not that it needs to be one party or the, you know, I want to win all the time as a member, you know, of the system. You know, it just needs to be people participating in good faith, and there's been very little of that, and it's been these kinds of obstructionist leaders that are basically wasting my time and many other people's time that they have, and that's it's just so such a deep wound. I think we're not even present to how many people are affected by that. So.
Okay, so that's two problems we've solved. What's next on the Israel and the Middle East? You know what?
That's fixed.
Is it fixed? Well, you know, we don't have time for that. Not this week. Maybe next week. Can we do that next week? Because there's other things we have to get to, and I don't know if we can do Israel and the Middle East within the 5 minutes that we have allocated. Here, this just happened. This is more interesting, I think.
What?
The January 6th inquiry has subpoenaed Giuliani and the legal team that made claims of voting fraud. That's according to the New York Times. This just came out. House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol today subpoenaed Rudolph Giuliani and his entire legal team that pursued a set of conspiracy-filled lawsuits on behalf of former President Trump that made claims of fraud in the 2020 presidential election. That means Giuliani has been subpoenaed, Sidney Powell has been subpoenaed, Boris Epstein has been subpoenaed, and you know they're all just going to ignore the subpoena, which I never knew was an option. I never knew you could just ignore a subpoena and say, I'm not going to participate. You know, I really hope they come after these people and make them pay the penalty for not aiding in this investigation that we need to get to the bottom of. It's simply incredible to see how Republicans are trying to dismiss the whole thing. Same Republicans that condemned it on January 6th, now saying, you know what, wasn't so bad, wasn't a big deal. It's just good that their voices, their words are on record, and we can go back and play them and say, you said exactly the opposite. What changed? Well, we all know what changed. They talked to Trump. They got their threats. They got basically everybody who refused to kiss the ring has either left Congress or is being primaried out.
That's what that 50 votes for the voting rights thing, those missing Republican votes there, it's like fealty, not even to him specifically, but by association, the fealty and fear of the base,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to stay in power and refusing to stick your neck out for the right, for the doing the right thing in a moment where it's ever more critical. Again, like, it shouldn't be that it's one party that has an interest in more votes, and it should be more votes so that both parties have more opportunities and more variety, more dynamic, more changing, instead of a continuation of what has been and the sort of status quo that isn't actually moving legislation.
Well, these things never last. That's the important lesson to learn from all this. When you rule by intimidation, by lies, by trying to rewrite history, it might last a few years. You might get something. You might get a blemish in the annals of history. But in the end, democracy prevails. And I think that's what's going to happen here, because we have so many people who are awake and speaking out. And that's what's important for everybody out there, to not let this crap become normal. And I think we're in good position to fight this no matter what they throw at us.
Absolutely. Yeah. We don't have to put up with it.
Mm-mm.
No matter which and how you get down, what your issues are, you know, you deserve a better and more functional government.
All right. Hey, we went to see Steve Colbert last week. That was fun. We got tickets. We got tickets to actually go to a show on, well, we went on Thursday. But when you go on Thursday, here's a secret. When you go on Thursday, you get to see two shows, because the Friday show is actually taped on Thursday. Did you know that?
Why did you say?
Because everybody knows this.
Didn't we sign that
thing? No, you didn't. If you watch a Friday show of Steve Colbert late night, the monologue is never referring to anything that actually happened on Friday. And they always make a big deal of saying, yeah, it's Friday, because it's really not Friday when they say that. So that's kind of fun. But what do you think of the whole experience? We got there early. We got there, I think, around 2 o'clock. And we were literally the first ones online. You know, we weren't trying to be insane about this. We just thought, okay, somebody told us people line up at 11, and that's insane.
Well, there was a real concern that there wouldn't even be a show if the host or other people there was some sort of infection.
All the late night hosts got COVID.
Yeah, he was the only show in town, as it were.
Uh-huh. So yeah, we were able to get on the list. And we were first, and then after about 45 minutes being first and only people there, more people started to show up.
Yeah, we afforded ourselves plenty of time to stand around. It was fun to observe the city life there, the ebb and flow of things. There was like some art being installed in some building.
Across the street, yeah.
Yeah.
What was the name of that art delivery service that they have? FAST, that's what it is. Fine Arts Speedy Transport or something, I don't know. But yeah, that's if you want a
studio,
massive painting delivered, apparently there's a company that does that. But yeah.
And the lanes, it's like one way now. Apparently Broadway wasn't.
Broadway always was one way.
Oh, it was always one way. There's like an island there. Where
but there's
like,
less lanes. There's only one lane left.
Yeah, there's parking in the middle of the road.
And bicycle lanes and all that. But okay, let's get into the theater, because that's where all the action takes place. It's amazing. Whenever I go either to a hearing in Washington, D.C. or to some show someplace, I'm always amazed by how small everything actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. They definitely fill it out on all of the shots that you see broadcast. But mm-hmm. when you're there, it is intimate.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool. They basically, again, you have to stand online for a while, but everyone's super nice and helpful. And when you finally get in, we had great seats because we were there so earlier, right? You know, in the center, in the front. Of course, that also meant that you had a cameraman in front of you for a lot of the show as well, because they do have to film it.
That's okay. I like that stuff.
Yeah. You noticed the three big CBS cameras they have there all were different colors on the logo, right?
Yeah, they had like their own label that was different colors, and it was red, green, and blue.
RGB.
Yeah. which I thought was that was
significance of those three colors.
Well, that's the three colors that most of the images on your TV are made with.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a clever little detail that you would never see on TV. But there's so much of that, that the production and stage crew and there's just activity everywhere. And yeah. They make it look very, very easy. I know that it's probably different every single day, what they're encountering, what the audience
show
is
itself,
like.
The show itself is fun to watch, but yeah. Watching what's going on around the show, like what are the band members doing while Steve is doing his monologue? Are they paying attention? Are they laughing? What's his producer, who you never see on camera, what's he doing? And it's good to see the interaction. And you realize, I've been to a lot of shows, and I know that there's a lot of plastic and fakeness involved. In this case, Steve Colbert, it's all pretty genuine. It all really seems authentic. The way he is on television is the way that he interacts with people. And it just seems very sincere. And the thing that I like the best, which is probably what most people don't like, at least people involved, is when they mess up, when they have to stop and do something again because somebody flubs a line or somebody starts laughing. Or I think at the beginning of Thursday's show, the teleprompter stopped working. So he didn't have anything to say.
They had a technical difficulty.
That stopped things like 10 minutes, but he just took more questions from the audience. And it was basically just, you know, kind of funny in and of itself. And the warmth between John Batiste and Steve Colbert is very genuine. You can tell just by the way they interact. They say hi to each other before they say hi on the air, which is also nice. I don't know. The whole thing just, it was very positive, very uplifting. And that's not even taking into account the things that he says when he goes on the air, the way that he, as we just described, is one of these people who is outspoken about protecting democracy and fighting against all these people and entities that are trying to subvert the vote and all of that. It's a shot in the arm. It's something that you need to feel. You know, it's just you realize there's more people out there that are intelligent and awake and who care, and that just matters so much.
Absolutely, yeah. The people around you in the audience are also viewers,
mm-hmm.
and that takes that you don't get every time you like watch a show like that, or if you're into some programming like this, you know, it's a collective experience, and that thing that you're experiencing with other audience members, you never really see them, but mm-hmm. when you experience it elbow to elbow, you realize, wow, there are people out there understand the humor, or they're as interested or aware of whatever the topic is,
right.
Even if they don't like the joke or something like that, it's a good time, and that band really rocks the house.
Oh, they sure do.
That's a real show there.
Stay Human with John Batiste.
Absolutely.
But to speak to what you were referring to, yeah, you know, being with all these people, everybody is masked. Everybody has shown proof that they are vaccinated. It's so simple. It's so easy. And it's also really heartening to know that all the people around you care enough to do this. And aren't being belligerent about it, and everyone's just happy to be there. And that extends, you know, beyond the Ed Sullivan Theater, into the streets, into the mass transit system. You know, we took buses, we took subways, and honestly, didn't see a single person who wasn't wearing a mask this time. Everybody cares. Everybody's trying really hard. And you know, if you don't get that, there's something that you're just not paying attention to, because this is how we beat this. By uniting together, by caring about each other, and by slight inconveniences that will basically make it easier for us to come back to normal.
And good signage.
Like what kind of good signage?
I don't know. Whatever the policies or whatever is working for various establishments, it's got to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
And there was good signage everywhere. And the train felt, or the subway felt pretty good, considering just how many people are moving this way and that all around you there.
Now, every time I go to the city, I just have this feeling of warmth and caring that you might not think comes from a city. But when people are united against something and fighting to make things better, which is what they do, wearing a mask in that situation being vaccinated, you just get the sense that, okay, you know, we're all on the same side here. We're all working together, and this will be behind us before we know it. And it's, you know, it's getting better too. Omicron, the rates are going down. That's what was predicted. And the hope is that this will really start to peter out in the months ahead.
Certainly a thing that many health providers and workers are looking forward to, that system is being really taxed heavily.
Mm-hmm.
So just with long hours and incredible workloads. So I hope people are getting better.
You know, the other thing I learned from The Late Show, well, I'm going to give away another secret here, but when he does the interview with the main guest, that's usually broken up into three pieces when you watch it. It's all one piece when they do it. I didn't know that they were doing an edit. They did it so well that it fooled me. But basically, when he says, we have to go for a break right now, they do all of that at the end. They do that at the end, and then they chop the interview into three pieces, and they edit it in such a way that it looks like it's part of the conversation, but it's not. The other thing they do, they have a musical guest. You don't see the musical guest. Basically, you applaud the musical guest, and then you applaud having just seen them, which you didn't. So since we were seeing both the Friday and Thursday shows, there were two musical guests, and we didn't see either of them, but we applauded them.
We eventually saw them.
Well, yeah, but not there.
But so many performances are being done remotely, and I gotta say, I'm amazed at what musicians are doing now.
Mm-hmm.
With the tools and internet and just really creative production, like even lighting and projection or backgrounds and stuff. It's so cool, the level of performance people are doing for broadcast or like these conferences or streaming platforms.
Yeah,
they're able to appear, and they appear as though they're on the stage there themselves, but they may be in their own town, you know, at a soundstage.
But I want them on stage. I want to go back to that.
It doesn't replace it. Just like from a radio station perspective, and like I know you can't see the visuals necessarily, right, but the production quality, like really good sound quality and of course visuals if you are streaming it, it's incredible what a band is sort of asked to do but able to like step up to now. Like, it's incredible. Right.
But you need the interaction, you need the interview, you need to, you know, the presence. That's part of the whole thing. I get now it's hard to do that.
But you don't learn an instrument to be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna make this cool graphical background and this costume and lighting and all this stuff. Like, that's not why you play music. And I just think it's an interesting observation, the level of the sort of expectations even now that we're creating for musicians.
We are out of time. It's time for us to go. You can write to us, otw@2600.com. And Kyle, I found an old piece by Stay Human. Yeah, they have a record out that came out about 10 years ago. John Batiste is in the band, but I think most everybody else is different. So we're going to go out with this piece. And we'll see you next week, I guess.
Indeed. Ciao.
Good night.
The above, and I try to give you everything I got, but you want more than I can give, and no, I'm not. You play with my heart, babe. Tear my world apart. Why you gotta be like that? Why you gotta be like that? Why you gotta be like that?